Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I'm Ted Kluck, joined, as always, in studio by Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. And boys, we have a lot to cover today. We have another entirely listener-generated podcast. So if you're a listener, number one, we thank you. Number two, come out to Live in Louisville the weekend of October 23rd. And we will have some t-shirts, some missional wear generated t-shirts, and we'll also have burlap sacks. I hope we'll have burlap sacks. Maybe
possibly burlap t-shirts.
We're going to have
a lot of burlap. I would love a burlap t-shirt.
We're going to have burlap deposit slips too, if you want to give to our program.
And handcrafted leather tracks, gospel tracks,
mm-hmm.
that will cost $86 a piece, mm-hmm. but will be worth every penny. Boys, we have some business to do. Speaking of business, with a sponsor. So Pipe, why don't you tell our good listeners about, Moody Press and what they're selling this week, and then we'll get into this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Last episode, we talked about how we needed to keep Moody Publishers on the hook. We couldn't just let them off easy and be too thankful for their efforts, and they came through again with another episode sponsorship for us. They are highlighting the book Life in Community, Joining Together to Display the Gospel by Dustin Willis. Dustin oversees a lot of the work that the North American Mission Board does, so it's a ton of church planting, ton of their church planting efforts and things like that. The SEND conference falls under his responsibilities. He's a really good guy. This book's been out for a little while, maybe a year, year and a half, but it takes a really good look at how the gospel is displayed uniquely when Christians live in community instead of just sort of, we think of sharing the gospel as talking to another person, but he draws out the idea of how the gospel is shown in how, you know, in forgiveness, in friendship, in generosity, in caring for others, in support for people, in conflict resolution, all these different things, and that can only happen in a community context. And then he gives some really good helpful tips for how people can do that, and not just like the typical small group kind of thing, but like in their neighborhood and opening homes and just being a good neighbor and being part of your community, not just sort of a cloistered Christian community. It's got a 6-week group study in it, so if you wanted to go through it with a group of a group from church, a small group, community group, missional community, whatever it is you call yours, you can do that. It's a really practical book, but draws out a lot of rich truths. So check that out. It is called Life in Community, Joining Together to Display the Gospel by Dustin Willis, published by Moody Publishers. And again, thank you to them for sponsoring the podcast for another episode.
Boys, you know how I know I'm getting older? And it kind of bums me out. There's guys named Dustin doing books. You know what I mean?
And he's like our age, though.
Is he?
He's not. I think he's older than I am, which makes him closer to your age, rather than probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's probably mid to late 30s. So. All right.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just a sense of, I don't know. I'm moving through this thing a little bit.
There was nobody named Dustin in my graduating class.
Guys are named Theodore and Ronald, so it's not like you have young guy names.
We've got vintage names.
That's true.
Yeah, vintage.
You have
retro names.
Timeless names. Like there's a lot of substance to those names, but picking on somebody else for their name doesn't seem fair. And this is coming from somebody with a name that's very easy to pick on.
So. I know. I just feel like Dustin was a name that was invented in like 1982.
I know, man. Yeah. There were some Dustins in my town, but they were like a few years behind me in school.
So how do you guys feel about the trend of giving kids last names as first names now?
Oh, that's huge down here.
I mean, well, and maybe it's just
I don't really
a
have any
thing.
Room to talk on that one, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, you know, I have one of those.
Why? Your kid's called Beth. I mean...
That's oh, Mike, I was thinking of me. I have two first names. But yeah, I guess what you're saying
but
is...
Like, but like the naming your kid like Cooper
or,
Anderson or like there's all these different... There's these last names that are now first names. And I'm like, what? When did we just decide that name construct doesn't matter anymore? Like you could be named Cooper or something like that. This is really confusing to me.
You actually could be named Piper too. That's interesting.
That's true. Piper tends to be a girl's name, I think.
It is, yeah.
Which really,
there's no...
It confuses people. Like when I when I order at Starbucks or something, and they ask for my name, I never tell them Barnabas because they can't spell Tim. So yeah. So I tell them Piper, and they
so
look
you tell
at
them
me
Piper. They're expecting like a 14-year-old girl to come.
Exactly. They're like, oh, is that for your daughter or your cousin or something? No, it's for me.
That's so interesting because I always give my last name too. I don't know if that's just like an old school thing to do, but I never give my first name because whenever I say Ronnie, it always comes out as Robert or Donnie, which I don't really care about. But that's why I always go last name. You know. But I mean, interesting.
Starbucks has a gift for butchering names. I'm sure they can butcher Martin as well. They call you like Maddie or something like that.
You know what's weird, man? Like, we got to get into this on another podcast, but the whole like what people are naming their kids thing, and I know that's always going to be a generational thing, but I feel like it's like the last bastion for like creativeness for non-creatives, and that's how way they get creative is by like naming their kid like Oogly Gagoogly, you know, Smith.
Is it creative if you just go look online for creative baby names? Like, you Google creative baby names and you're like, oh, Breck.
I just feel like it's the name
of a hockey player from 1994 who wears a sweater over his shoulder. Sorry.
And I always feel like it's people you talk to, and it's like, it's not to say anything bad about them. It's just like, they're not creative types. And then you listen to the name of their kid and you go, oh, his name's Trevor. Like, I don't even know. Is that an object? Like, I don't even know what that name means. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you just think like, well, okay, that's interesting that the one thing in your life that came out creative is your kid.
Yeah, dude, it's sort of like it's their one chance to shine, you know?
Of course, then there's my parents who just mind the Bible for, they're like, huh, I wonder which names nobody's ever used for good reason. How about Barnabas? Good, let's slap that on a kid.
Dude, what are the other...
It'll make him resilient.
What are your brother's names? Speaking of that.
My oldest brother is Karsten, which is not a biblical name, but he was born in Germany when my dad was doing doctor work, and it's like a German derivative for the name Christian.
Okay.
So he's starting baseline. We got Christian kids here.
Yeah. That's kind of arty. That's arty.
Then there's Ben or Benjamin, okay, which is not an uncommon name, but decidedly biblical. Then there's Abraham.
Sure.
Abe. Good old honest Abe.
I don't think he enjoys being called Abe.
I'm certain he doesn't.
Beat the bejesus out of me for it. and then there's me, and then my little sister is Talitha, which... She rivals me for obscure biblical names because it's not even a name. It's a term of affection used one time in the Bible when Jesus raises the little girl from the dead.
That's right.
Wow.
So if my parents had decided to adopt another kid, they would have named him like Maher Shalal Hashbaz or something like that and gone like straight into First Chronicles names and just pulled one out.
They're going to name him Zondervan for a Bible distributor, you know.
That's right. Yeah. Tyndale.
Piper, you're so obscure. Piper. You're so obscure.
So obscure, so thoughtful. Crossway Piper.
Exactly. Holman Piper.
Actually, obviously, his name would be Lifeway, but we don't have to get into that right now.
Yeah. Well, so we should sell the naming rights to our kids. You know?
That's genius. I wonder if
we're the ultimate business.
Is that like an annual renewed lease or a one-time fee thing? Because I'm into like the stable ongoing income.
That's up to us to make it whatever we want. Ooh. It's the one thing we have control over was naming our kids.
I agree. Now, guys, speaking of naming, and this is nutty to me. Okay, so this is topic number one. But and again, I'm not on Twitter, whatever. But I'm aware of what goes on, somewhat. And so my question is, what's the deal with all these fictional Calvinist characters in the Twitter sphere? All right, so you got like Calvinist Batman, Calvinist Chewbacca, Calvinist Bruce Wayne, you know, I don't know, Calvinist
There's like Calvinist obscure Hobbit characters.
Yeah, dude, Judas Priest, what's up with this? Like, is this funny? Is it clever? I don't read these people's Twitter
feed. It one person doing all of them?
Is it one person doing all of them? Like, what's going on here? Like, what itch is that scratching? You know what I'm saying?
Could Chewbacca be a Calvinist?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's some theological questions here as well.
Right.
I feel
like
Bruce Wayne was probably not a great Calvinist because he had lots of money, and we all know that Calvinists feel guilty about having lots of money.
Right. So, and he didn't have a huge family to support either.
Except for all the rich Calvinists out there.
Yeah.
Shh.
We don't
point out hypocrisies. That's not what we do.
Yeah.
Except for all the rich Calvinist celebrities out there. Other than them, there are in this tribe. No money in this tribe at all. Yeah.
Bruce Wayne was kind of miserable, though, and maudlin. That would sort of lend itself.
No, I think Bruce Wayne was totally reformed. Nobody can be that miserable and angry without being, you know, I mean, I,
absolutely.
You know, yeah, I don't see him going to Craig Groeschel's church, you know, in between like, you know, jaunts out into Gotham at, you know, 2 a.m. You know,
doing CrossFit with our boy Stephen Furtick. How do you think he got so fit? Hanging off of buildings and swinging around.
You know what? Let's just say it right now, man. He's complex. Bruce Wayne is complex.
He's multifaceted.
He's a guy that would say, you know, I'm a 4-point guy. I'm a 4-pointer.
Yeah.
You know, that would be Bruce Wayne. 4.5-pointer.
I'm going to suss it out for you sometime.
Right. Exactly.
Not right now because I'm sad. I'm miserable.
That's right. I'm moping in my huge mansion alone. Well, with Alfred. Why are there not like semi-Pelagian Batmans?
Yeah.
Is it because Batman was taken? Or, like, do other people not self-define as something as much as Calvinists? I know they don't self-define as much as Calvinists do. But, yeah, the whole
phenomenon. Why is there not, like, Lutheran Batman?
You know? Yeah, there are some Baptist ones out there, too. But those tend to be, like, Baptist accounts as opposed, like, so there's, like, Baptist news or whatever. But they don't take on fictional, like, the fictional character thing just befuddles me.
Well, Pipe, what are they like? Okay, what do they post? Like, for instance, like, what does Calvinist Batman even say? What does he say?
Well, Calvinist Batman has a podcast, and he's unlike the real Batman. He actually will reveal his real identity on occasion. I met him at the Gospel Coalition because it's kind of like Comic Con for Reformed people.
Was he dressed as Batman?
If only.
Well, would you just tell Jared Wilson to use his own name every once in a while, man?
Yeah,
I mean, seriously.
He might run half a dozen of these accounts. But
wait, what are you guys saying? He doesn't like Twitter.
Jared Wilson, no, he never tweets.
Yeah.
And he
doesn't spend his whole day on Twitter.
He avoids controversy on Twitter like the plague, too.
Absolutely.
But no, like I've the Calvinist Batman one, he's taken that. I mean, it's not a persona at this point as much as it is just like a name. It kind of has – the Batman thing I think has sort of lost its meaning because he has a podcast. He has whatever. He interviews people about – I mean, it's pretty reformed, but he interviews about books and things like that. I've been on the podcast. He's a good dude. The other ones are just sort of like random people who have claimed an alter ego and slapped Calvinist on the front, but they – the Chewbacca one actually tweets as Chewbacca. Like, there's a lot of growling in the tweets. It's really unusual.
Mm.
I'm afraid to say too many mean things about him because he listens to the podcast. I'm assuming it's a he. Could be a she. Probably shouldn't be sexist.
It's not a she.
Are we just assuming that women have more sense than this? All the women are just shaking their heads being like,
yes, it's not
it's
a she.
Definitely
sheet.
Not.
It's not sexist. It's just respectful.
Okay. Yeah. Good. That's what I meant. although there was the happy Chewbacca lady who got her kids' college paid for by wearing a mask and laughing for 7 minutes on camera. So,
you mean most brilliant businesswoman that maybe has ever existed in the history of mankind?
Again, just being respectful.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. I'm just so confused by Calvinist Batman and all that stuff. I just don't even, like, I don't know. I don't know.
Calvinist alter egos.
There's a question mark floating over my head right now.
Hit us up on Twitter at Happy Rant Pod and tell us why in the world you use an alter ego and slap Calvinist on the front. Is it because you're afraid to be Calvinist under your own name? Maybe that's it. Maybe we should accuse them of being cowards.
Calvinist Bill?
Yeah, I mean,
Calvinist Bill. It doesn't exactly have the same ring to it.
Maybe
does it?
Calvinist Chewbacca is somebody who is like he's the executive pastor at a super Arminian church, and he's afraid to out himself, so he has to claim an alter ego.
That's a brilliant point. Calvinist Chewbacca could be that lady that did all the laughing in the car too.
No, she was way too happy to be Calvinist. We covered this already.
That's true.
I've got some Calvinist Twitter personas that I would like to see. I'd like to see a Calvinist Mike Tyson.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, nobody's stopping you from doing that, Big T. I mean,
no, I'm not going to create it. I want someone else to do it.
That's yours for the taking.
I want Calvinist Mike Tyson. I want to see like a Calvinist like Tupac or Calvinist 50 Cent, you know, kind of melding the rap persona and Calvin.
Calvinist Kanye could start every tweet with
Calvinist
I'm
going to
let you finish.
I love it.
Nope. How about a Calvinist Ted Cluck? How about that, Big T?
How about just Ted Cluck? Get Ted on Twitter.
There you go.
At Ted Cluck. At
promoting another
Ted
thing.
Exactly.
I love it. Guys, let's transition. to something equally vapid and stupid. And that is the show The Bachelor. A reader had a great question, which is, why do people like The Bachelor? One question just to start. Are you guys frequenters of The Bachelor? Do you watch these shows?
That was a little vibrato right there for you boys. The answer is no for me. Like, I think, like, back in the old days of it, like, whatever that was, like 47 years ago when they started it.
Yeah.
I think I caught like half a season, and I don't remember why. And I remember just being angry the whole, and there's the Calvinist thing. I just remember being like angry the whole time while I was watching it. But like, it was just so baffling to me. Like the level of just complete ridiculousness / stupidity just like confounded me, even beyond other like reality shows. You know what I mean? I feel like that one was just, why doesn't anybody have any respect? It's just unbelievable to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I
have watched probably 2 episodes, and it has been since, whatever that same era was, whenever it first started. Around the time Survivor started, I think, was also when this started. So we're talking a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. My thought was always just like it, because I think when it started, it was kind of in the heyday of reality TV. And so people still took the word reality seriously at that point. And they were like, wow, this is stuff you've never seen anywhere else. Look at, like, this is real drama, not realizing that the producers were way ahead of them and it was all contrived nonsense. But but now I just look at it and I think people watch for one of 2 reasons. There is still the crowd who really wants somebody to fall in love, and they think that whatever's happening on screen is actually falling in love. Pity upon those people for being suckers. Then there's the crowd who watches it because they like watching train wrecks. You know, it's like the same people who watch Funniest Home Videos because they like nut shots. And but like the romantic version of a nut shot. And, and so that's what I mean because I have friends who I work with who like live tweet The Bachelor and Bachelorette, and they basically make fun of it the whole time. Like, they're not drawn into the drama because they have any empathy for the people.
But, yeah, Pipe, that's kind of become a thing.
But they're totally into the show. It's like,
that's kind of become a thing, yeah. It's like, let's make fun of The Bachelor.
It's like hate tweeting, but they love the show. So it's not like hate watching. It's mock watching, but they love to mock it. It's this really strange thing.
That's kind of what's come
on Twitter.
That's kind of what's come out of it, because I got friends that have done that too, where they say, okay, you know what this means, right? The new season of The Bachelor means that we're going to be like, you know, doing all of our mocking tweeting, like, kind of thing. You know what I mean? So it's like weird that that's become a thing that's sort of risen out of that.
And
it's a romantic version of a nutshot. Until next time, folks. Rachel the Hell Evans.
I love to mock stuff as much or more than anybody, but I can't think of anything that I engage in purely for the sake of mocking it. Mocking is just a thing that happens when something dumb goes on. Like,
dude, the mocking, it has to be organic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, you have to stumble into the opportunity and go, oh, wow, that joke just wrote itself in my Twitter account.
Because that's what makes it funny. Yeah, if you log onto Twitter and you go, I'm going to be funny now for the next half hour while I watch The Bachelor,
you're not going to be funny.
It's not funny. Yeah, you're not going to be funny.
It's like Jared Wilson tweeting NFL games. What are you eating, Ted?
Just a granola bar. I got hungry. Sorry, guys.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Just keeping it real.
Yeah. Just masticating into the microphone.
Too loud.
Bad.
What kind of granola bar? Is it like one of those Nature Valley one that crumbles everywhere, or is it a
chewy one? It's I don't eat the crumbly ones. It's one of the ones that's like dipped in chocolate, so it's basically a candy bar.
It's a candy bar. I'm trying to write down the word masticating for Sundays. Hold on, guys.
Do not misspell that. You will get yourself in all sorts of trouble.
I realize that. Okay. What's our next topic, Big T?
Baby, the last topic. Last topic is what is your book writing masticating process? Are you guys ready to be serious here?
Fine.
Come on, gentlemen. Let's raise the level of discourse here on the program.
Oh, man. I had somebody ask me that the other day. I had somebody sit down with me, and they said, okay. And they basically laid out everything they thought it was going to be. Like, so they took like 12 minutes to tell me what they thought my book writing process was.
Yeah.
And I literally got to the end of it, and I said, well, it's actually nothing like that.
Dude,
in fact,
good hustle.
And the whole point of the coffee was they wanted an introduction to your agent.
Right,
and
pretty
it was
much.
Just masked in a discussion of your book writing process.
That was part of it. And it was like, so tell me about how you do your outline. And then there's this. And then you come back to this. And then when you do research, obviously he's never heard this program because he wouldn't have mentioned the word research. And so we got to the end of it. And I was like, well, here's the deal, pal. I go, it's nothing like that at all. Not even close. No. Okay, so for me, I'm sort of a. You know, I'm a little more of a stream of consciousness kind of a writer. So what I do is I figure out sort of the overall topic or chapter or theme, and I just start writing.
Is like, that, I don't, where does the opium come in?
Well, that, I mean, that's before, but like okay. I start writing and I start writing and I just start getting just content or whatever you want to call it down on the page. And then really all the magic happens during the editing process for me. But I don't do outlines. I don't get that intricate with it. It has to just sort of be in the moment, kind of what's going on. And then I go back and add more of the more specific
content.
How
do you handle the book proposal process where they say we need an outline? Do you just make one up and then ignore it when you're actually writing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because really it's just to kind of give sort of a – I just look at book proposals as being sort of the general idea. So I just sort of get through that part and say this is kind of what I think directionally it could be or
doing book proposals.
Yeah, for me it's kind of it's sort of one of those, you know, necessary evils. And then but I mean it gives you a little structure, but at the same time, yeah, it's just not how my mind works, you know, but that's just me. What about you, Pud?
Well, I feel the same way as Ted about book proposals. I hate them. I feel like once you've been published, a book proposal becomes even less meaningful because mm-hmm. you know people in the industry. You can just talk to somebody. You can talk through your idea. They will know what you're going to write before you ever write a book proposal. That's for the publisher's sake to have so they can take it to their marketing people and stuff like that, and they can kind of build a business case for it. It's essentially a business proposal, not a book proposal.
It's true.
So for all of you writers who think that book writing is this wonderful creative process, it's half business proposal until you actually, you know, for a while, and it's kind of crappy in that way. But the actual book writing process is whatever the idea is, you know, I keep a rolling list of potential ideas, most of which are half baked and will never turn into anything. But then I, you know, occasionally I'll land on one that I look at and I go, there might be something there. And that's when I kind of start doing the outlining process because I have to see if there's enough there to get 30, 50,000 words out of it. And I'll outline it because I need some sort of framework to work within. But the outline is really general. It's just sort of taking it block by block. So it's sort of like, I'm going to look at it from this angle, take this aspect, this application, whatever. The three books that I've done, one of which doesn't come out for a few more months, they're all kind of idea books. And so maybe it would be different if I was writing stories. You know, Ted has done more kind of journalistic story writing kind of mm-hmm. books, and maybe the process for that is different. I'm sure there's more research and interview and things like that. I don't like research. I hate research. And, I don't do a ton for my books because I gloss it under the banner of, I don't want outside influences changing how I view this. You know, I want to bring my perspective because otherwise why am I writing this? And I'm never impressed with a book where they quote a ton of different people's perspectives.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, that's just a collection of stuff. Like, that's, I came here because I wanted the author's perspective on this. But that might also just be laziness on my part. I don't know. So the writing process itself, I tend to do 70% of the writing in the last month before the due date.
Yeah. So you're a deadline guy. I'm kind of like that too. I do my best writing under pressure.
I have a really hard time honing in and really kind of clearing my mind and focusing on the project at hand unless I have something looming. Mm-hmm. You know, so if I try to write, you know, if I have 9 months to write a book, I'll write three chapters over 7 months and, you know, six to nine chapters over the last 2 months.
Yeah.
Just because that's, I don't know. That's how I focus best. It's when I can carve out time. And then, I just take it in like 3 to 5 hour blocks. I can't write for more than about 4 or 5 hours without my brain melting. So
Now let me. That's good. Now let me, Big T. If it's okay, man. If it's all good with you, I'd like to set up your piece in this a little bit because you know, for the listeners that don't know, you know, me and Ted have written 2 books together. We have a new one coming out July 17th called The Bridezilla of Christ. Now, Ted is a fascinating writer to me, and I think one of the stories I think that's worth telling about our current book that's coming out is that. When I pitched the idea to Big T, which was in like a little coffee shop here in my hometown of Ashland, Ohio.
It was 6 years ago, it feels like.
It was about 2 years ago. I pitched him the idea. He liked it. And before I knew it, I'm telling him all about it. And Ted is just clicking away, you know, on his lap tee. And before I knew it, you know, we talked it through. He was asking questions. I was giving him kind of the concept, you know, back and forth. And about an hour and a half later, Big T goes, okay, I have the first chapter done. and he literally reads it out. He kind of set up the whole premise of the book in it. I thought it was brilliant, and it literally is. It became almost unedited from that point, the first chapter of the book. Right, Big T?
Yeah. It did, baby. Yeah, thanks for that setup. Yeah, I think
is that the one about the beige men?
That's the prologue.
That's the prologue.
This is actually chapter one. Chapter one.
Okay,
proper.
Gotcha. Yeah. I remember reading that phrase and I thought it was genius. So it stood out in my mind.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you. Yeah, that's it, Big R. I'm definitely probably a lot like you, like just a strike while the iron's hot kind of guy. So if I find myself kind of inspired or talking with somebody who's interesting, you know, I just kind of let the story write itself. And I think for me, like, you know, I'm writing in my head all the time, like, you know, in the shower, driving the car, whatever, such that when I finally get to the lap tee, like, I sort of have it the way I want it in my mind. And I can just put it on paper. So yeah, I'm not a big outliner. I don't do a lot of outlining. You know, like Pipe said, I tend to be more sort of journalistic in my approach, in that, you know, I'm talking to people and kind of thinking more in terms of scenes and characters, I think, in my writing than, you know,
you're kind of an observer, Big T. Would you say that's accurate?
Dude, yeah. I think that's totally accurate. That's one of the things I love the most about writing, actually, is the observing that you have to do, you know. So being able to go, and I tell this to my students, you know, being the guy who can go into a room and pick out the interesting thing or the interesting person, and just to be a good watcher and listener and be aware of what makes for a good story. You know, I think those are the things that kind of turn me on about writing, or that make it exciting. So those are also the things that tend to kind of drive my process. So yeah, I hate doing the book prop. That's a totally, you know, I forget if it's left brain, right brain, whatever, but that's the analytical, like, business brain that has to.
I think that's the left brain.
I think it's the left brain. Yeah, that's the one that has to put the book prop together. And I tend to be more right-brained in my approach to actually doing the writing.
Yeah. And like, for me, a book proposal is not super hard to do because I've worked in marketing and a bunch. Yeah. So it just, but it is switching from, it has no bearing whatsoever on the book writing itself.
It is
purely a proposal on how can we sell this thing.
Well, it's a sales document for salespeople. You know, you're not writing for the actual audience, and you're not even really writing for the editor. You're writing so that the editor can take this to, like, you know, the sales guys around the table who figure out how many copies they can sell.
All right. So speaking of editors, what you guys have both turned in different, you know, multiple manuscripts. What feedback do you consistently get from editors after your first draft?
That's a good question.
Like, is there something that you constantly hear back from them, or regularly hear back, like, hey, I would love to see more of this or less of this, or you know, whatever.
Big R, why don't you take that one first?
I've had a really good experience with editors, and the thing, so I always get more of a positive thing from editors, which would be not like, cut this out, we don't really understand where you're going with this. What I get is, I'll get like a highlighted sentence, which will be like a concept that they just feel like I didn't flesh out, and they wish I would have just fleshed that out. So it's something that I kind of did as a connector. And they say, no, this should be like half the chapter. Why don't you just flesh this out, make the chapter longer, and then connect it to your next point. So it's usually something that the editor almost like deemed as incomplete for me, and then I just have to add to it. So that's kind of the one I seem to get kind of thrown at me, leveled at me.
And that right there is an editor being good at their job.
That's true.
Because they're picking out a concept that would strengthen the book and letting you strengthen it. They're not messing with your they're not messing with anything you did. And that's, I appreciate when I get that kind of feedback from editors.
Yeah, no, that's been good for me. I mean, again, only being three books into this whole gig, you know, unlike T, who's 30 books in, that's been good for me. That's been good for me so far. Yeah.
31, Ted, baby.
Ted, have editors given up on giving you feedback?
Dude, they kind of have, which is great. I'm really glad I'm at that spot in my career. But no, I usually, the feedback takes one of two forms, one of which is, I love your writing, I'm your biggest fan, you know, take out the word douche and we're good, you know.
Don't use the word suck or crap.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And it's such that, like, some of my really good friends who have read most of my books have a game where they try to pick out the words that the editors have changed for me.
Yes.
Like the words that just totally don't sound like me. So I get some of that. And then I get, on the other end of the continuum, the editor who is like, you know, hey, I really appreciate what you've done here. Subtext, I can't say that I like it because I don't like it. So they'll say things like, I appreciate your hard work, you know, on this.
That's right. That's subtext. You just got the Hustle Award.
Yeah. Subtext, I hate your work, you know. And then they basically proceed to say, like, we want it to sound more like Al Mohler.
Yeah, but that's what's fascinating, because I've lived through that a couple times. Because your writing is not so didactic, you know what I mean? It's not teaching as much. Yeah. I just feel like editors come in and they have a hard time, like, sort of getting where you're at.
Yep.
You know
they're
what
like,
I mean?
They're like, I appreciate the story. Subtext, I hate the story.
Right.
I appreciate the story, but where's the application?
You know, absolutely.
Things like that. Yeah. Well, where's the take home?
That's so funny, because I tend to write lean in terms of, you know, it's an editor's nightmare when an author turns in a manuscript way above word count, you know? So if the word, they want a 50,000 word manuscript, you turn it in at 65. Editors are not thrilled with that, because they have to convince the author to cut 15,000 words that the author is clinging to.
It's all about paper, man.
Right,
they don't want to pay for the extra paper.
Well, yeah, or they just, you know, whatever it is, it has as much to do with the fact that it's already listed on Amazon as 178 pages, and
exactly.
That would be 192 pages, and that's not okay. But I tend to turn in under word count consistently.
I do, likewise.
And, which means that the feedback I get from editors, while frustrating on occasion, is usually it's okay, because it's telling me to add stuff. And adding, at least I get to put it in my own words instead of having them come in and rearrange things. But I consistently get, you need more stories. So one of my least favorite things about Christian books is how every chapter starts the same way for every pastor who authors every book.
Oh, yeah.
Personal story, connection, sermon. I mean, it's just consistent. And I'm like, honestly, I don't care about your trip to
Honduras.
Yeah, your trip to Honduras. Well, that's the thing is, yeah, it's always drawing on their most extraordinary speeches, or they're trying to make something out of the mundane, and they're like, you know, I used to go to the barbershop with my grandfather, and then they spend 7,000 words describing how the barbershop smelled and the old men and the Coke bottles and stuff.
I love that barbershop story, Al Mohler.
But I don't tend to do that, because I'm writing concepts. And I just feel like I'm going to give the reader some credit. If the reader needs a story to get to the concept, wrong book.
Yeah.
I mean, they already bought it, so I win. But
dude, and see, my whole thing is writing stories. Like, I just write the story, and I don't write all the junk that comes after it.
And both of those styles should be valid, because on the one hand, you're connecting with the concept person, and the other hand, you're connecting with the story person. The reader should be able to take the leap to apply this. So for me, they should be able to say, oh, I can think of a story where that makes sense. For you, they're looking at it going, oh, I can take that and bring it into my real life or whatever.
Dude, don't you feel like in general, and this may be like stepping on toes here, but I feel like Christian publishing has a really low view of the reader.
Yes, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
True. Yep.
Yeah, like Big T, we really gotta make this explicit for the reader. And I'm like, you know what? The readers of this book are not stupid. Like, they'll get it. You know, just trust me.
Yeah, when one of the points that I got pushback on from an editor when I did Help My Unbelief was they wanted like thought questions at the end of the chapter.
Yeah.
And I just told them I'm not gonna do it. Like, if people don't want to think about my book, they're not going to. And
yeah,
I'm
the whole
not
point
and
of
I'm
that
not gonna spoon feed them.
Right.
Like, they're either thoughtful or they're not. And I would like to give the reader some credit. Now, it's possible that I'm giving people too much credit, but I also feel like if nobody gives the readers credit, the readers are going to collectively get dumber. So yeah. We should probably try to stretch their brains a little bit.
Or they'll collectively get offended and just walk away, you know.
Or they won't be collected at all. Nobody buys the book.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's true. When I say collected, I'm speaking very small numbers of readers here. But
Yeah.
I don't have mass influence with my publications.
No, I don't think anyone on this program does. We have mass influence with this program, though, boys.
Mass. Huge.
So feel good about that.
Yeah.
I wonder when we're all going to co-write a book called The Happy Rant, guys. Just a thought.
Dude, no, you know what it's going to be, Big R? It's going to be in like 30 years, and it's going to be the oral history of The Happy Rant. And it's going to be one of these 600 pagers.
Written by Al Mohler's son?
Yeah, just compiled by someone, and it'll be all these just random quotes about the excess and the decadence.
Well, the people who do that are always like the siblings or the children of whoever it's about. So, Ronnie, I propose that your daughter is the one who does the compilation because she's a listener, so she's engaged. She's, from everything you've said, she's very sharp. I bet she would... she'd do a bang-up job.
She's a good writer. She's an artist. She's listening right now. Hey, babe. So just get on that. And start, I would tell you to start outlining it, but we don't do outlines in our family. So just start writing.
Track down Calvinist Chewbacca, because also an avid listener, lots of interesting things to say in growls. So that there's a good starting point.
And track down everyone who we've offended.
That's a longer list.
Including Les Landfear.
That's right.
Track down every topic and every person that we've ever mentioned on this program, okay, Rachel Lehel Evans.
You just brought up Les Landfear, and I feel like I should throw this out. After, what was it, 2 episodes ago when we did the Calvinist documentary thing, Les contacted me on Facebook, is an exceptionally gracious person. Mm-hmm. And so despite our snark, Les responded graciously. So I would like to... I would just like to mention that because while we can be very critical, I do appreciate people who have a good sense of humor and did not – I mean, no firing back on that. So props to Les and thank you for your very thick skin and good sense of humor.
He's Les, a you're a great guy. We all just wish we were part of your movie.
No, we want the rivalry with the Reform Pubcast. I think we should beat that drum a little harder and louder.
Well, I want the rivalry, and I think the rivalry would best be played out on his movie.
Oh, I love it. So,
sort of a Calvinist sectarian thing.
Absolutely. Like, we can have in-house, you know, debates, you know, like in-house podcast debates. Absolutely. You know?
Absolutely.
It's like we're more Reformed than they are because we're less Reformed.
We're reforming the Reformed, and we might even be reforming those who are reforming the Reformed. So I think that makes us like the Uber Reformers.
I think we're the most Reformed 3 people in the world.
Think about that.
Rachel the Held Evans.
Until next time, Rachel the Held Evans.
You're fearfully and wonderfully made. God looks at your heart, not your jean size. Do you know the verses, yet still stress over your body? Oh, I get it. I was raised in church, but I struggled with food, eating disorders, and my body for decades. I'm Heather Creekmore, host of the Compare To You podcast, where we talk about all things body image and comparison from a biblical perspective. We get real about the pressure to focus on appearance in a culture where looks seem to matter most. Whether you're wrestling wrinkles or battling the scale, Compare To Who is the show for you. You'll laugh a little and be encouraged a lot. If you're ready to stop comparing and start living, visit lifeaudio.com to listen and subscribe.